Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Any account of British history in the 18th century, which is restricted to the British Isles, would seem from a global position to be rather limited. As it is, we've moved from the old certainties of the Oxford history, which presented an image of English history as being essentially what you needed to know about. We've moved much more to an understanding of the British dimension. And while historians, for example, of the 1980s and 1990s might have disagreed, sometimes famously so, people as varied, major scholars as varied as Linda Colley and Jonathan Clark, all argued the need to see the history of the British Isles at the British dimension. Indeed, in one respect, one might actually argue that there was an underrating of both the English component of the history and the dynamic which so often came from London, but also the regional dynamic of English history. But leaving that to one side, wherever one puts the emphasis in terms of the British Isles, it's quite clear that now, if one is looking at this question, not just from a international dimension, but indeed from a British dimension as well, we perforce need to consider the wider viewpoint. Now, it would be wrong to imagine that that is in some way new. One of the most farcical and ridiculous aspects of the many farcical and ridiculous aspects of the criticism of the, as it were, old history by self-styled radicals of the present moment is to imagine that British scholars of the past, and indeed foreign scholars of Britain of the past, did not devote due attention to major themes in imperial policy, whether warfare or peace, whether administration or migration, etc., etc. So this is not new. The issue I really want to address today is where best to put the balance and the emphasis. And here we have the difficulty, a difficulty that in a sense is much greater than my topic in the last two talks on this in this section, that there is a very articulate and indeed to a certain extent institutionally funded and favoured approach which argues in terms of looking at that period very much with regard to a present day perspective, which is a mixture of criticism and contrition, with the emphasis, of course, therefore, very heavily on British participation in the Atlantic slave trade, and also a number of people being very concerned with British policy in India. Now, in both cases, I think we could fairly say that there has been a certain amount of recent work that is interesting, certain amount of it that is useful, and a lot which is quite frankly a very low standard, although strong on the rhetoric. I find it very difficult, for instance, to approach the works of William Dalrymple on India without a sense of a weary predictability as he builds up from yet another assault on the Raj. And one can have a similar perspective with some of the rather tedious works which endlessly talk about the Atlantic slave trade and ignore the very strong agency of the Africans who sold other Africans. That doesn't in any way make the role of the British traders less or more worthy of consideration or less or more worthy of us adopting a particular perspective to it, but it should be part of the understanding of both process and context. Moving from these kind of very immediate, almost knee-jerk responses to the British position, I think there are a number of more profound questions that one needs to ask. First, how far should the British presence in the wider world be considered as different to that of other European empires? And if so, in what way? And secondly, how far does Britain as an imperial power, and indeed a power operating on a wider scale, match comparison, as indeed also other European trading empires did, with non-European empires, whether one is considering the Ottomans or the Safavids, the Durranis or the Mughals, the Manchu, so on? And that, again, is an interesting question, because it is all too often the case that imperialism, and indeed a presence in the wider world, is treated as some sort of pathology of Europe, or more particularly Britain, which is not only ignorant, and, you know, one despairs, but actually why bother with the ignorance? But it is more the question that it actually raises more interesting analytical questions of how far one, how best to proceed conceptually, methodologically, and historiographically in terms of contrast and comparison. Now, I tried my hand at this in a number of works, and readers may be interested in my book, Imperial Legacies, The British Empire Around the World, which is, I think, or I would hope, an interesting discussion of the actual nature of empire in a comparative context. And I have to say, both those who have written in favour of empire and those who've criticised it tend to, alas, be very Anglophone in their approach and not to put empire in these broader contexts. I think that's a problem with Nigel Biggar's recent book, which, you know, I mean, it doesn't say anything that people wouldn't have seen in Imperial Legacies, but more profoundly, it doesn't really address this question adequately of the specificity of the British experience or the degree to which it is non-exceptional. And I think the latter one is something we need to consider, and we might need to consider it in terms not of a particular ideology or not, though that element requires consideration and evaluation, but we might wish to consider it in terms, for example, of the balance between a maritime empire, a topic of my book, The British Seaborne Empire, or indeed the continental empires, some of which we mentioned earlier. And we might argue that the British Empire was different to, so we shall we say, the French Empire, the one with which it was most commonly compared and contrasted, partly for the ideological factors we've deferred to or briefly referred to, but more particularly because it is a maritime empire, while the French had a maritime component, but was very heavily a European empire in terms of its territorial aspirations and in terms of, as it were, its peer group context. So that question requires consideration. Separate to that comes the issue of whether the real interest of Britain in the 18th century on the global scale is not to do with slavery. After all, there were lots of non-Western powers that were slave powers. There were coercive labour systems as a whole were normal across most of the world, particularly once you include serfdom or enforced peasant labour. And on top of that, slavery was very strongly pronounced across the Islamic world, within sub-Saharan Africa, in the Indian Ocean sphere, etc., etc. So, you know, one might argue that if we want to look for what should be assessed in terms of a supposed British exceptionalism, or Sonderweg in the German idea, we should rather be considering industrialization, and in particular the role of Britain as helping to bring forward a new system of economic activity, and with that a kind of new society, and with that what one might call the onset of modernity, if modernity is to be understood in those terms, and that's always a movable feast. Now, from this perspective, one starts to get the more interesting questions in terms of the alleged divergence between the Western European, more specifically Britain, an East Asian, more specifically Chinese, economic model in the 18th century. We start to actually have to ask hard questions about the significance of the presence of coal and its importance as an economic transformer. We have to ask particularly about the role of which the industries powered by coal helped to create a new urban society within Britain. And it's reasonable to ask how far this affected Britain's position in the world as a whole. Now, much of the latter relates more to the 19th century. Much of what we call the Industrial Revolution came to fruition in the 19th century, and many of the key developments in terms of widespread use of factories, for example, are more particularly found in the 19th century than even the late 18th century, and so on with steam engines. And for example, as far as the steam engine is concerned, the locomotive steam engine, the movable steam engine, which we see most obviously in the steamship and the locomotive train, are technologies of the early 19th century rather than the 18th century. The 18th century had railways, of course, but the railways of the 18th century, for example, used to move coal from the Durham coalfield to the wharfs along the River Tyne for shipment to London. These were railways, but the wagons on them were pulled by horses. So it's not unimportant that they were railways, and they represented the use of enterprise and investment in order to produce a different outcome. And in the case of Causey Arch, the ruins of it survive, which survive, impressively survive in County Durham, you had the first major arch of that type since the Roman period. But nevertheless, I think one should really be talking about the 19th century there. So that then raises the question as to how far we're to look at 18th century developments in terms of the precursors or enablers of industrialization, and where again one puts one's emphasis. Now, those who want to criticize empire and, you know, read from a hymn sheet, which has all been written up for them nicely, will argue, of course, that profits accumulated in the slave sugar economy helped to finance other aspects of industrialization. They will argue that the model of exploitation is, as they see it, was one established, etc., etc. I think one can be a bit skeptical about some of those interpretations. First of all, the slave sugar society economic system was pronounced elsewhere. I mean, one can see it most obviously in Portugal, which was running in its colony of Brazil the largest slave economy of the Western Hemisphere. And I'm not aware that anybody has ever suggested that Portugal, interesting exact country as it is, was necessarily at the forefront of industrialization. So I think one has to be a bit cautious about this. And of course, there is also the Longburn theory of the precursors of industrialization, particularly growing use of coal, which would argue that rates of usage were increasing from the 16th century and would therefore suggest a lunt in the case of agriculture, the argument that particular characteristics of the English in particular rural economy with its openness to innovation and institutional and organizational factors that helped in that respect had a very long burn indeed, and therefore can't be brought into some kind of chronological overlap, still less a causative relationship with the case of slavery. And I think that's fairly clear cut. I don't think many people who are experts in the field would doubt that. And of course, given the significance of the rise in agricultural production, given the importance of developments within the British Isles, more particularly England, in terms of transport changes, the so-called transport revolution, given the significance of the so-called financial revolution beginning from the late 17th century, preceding in some respects the so-called political revolution of the Glorious Revolution, it's again unclear why we should put so much interpretation, as some critics would do, on a uni or monocausal explanation of economic change, indeed transformation. So one could argue that there is an interacting package here, that this interacting package is important because that in many senses, the mid-17th century British Isles is a failed state or series of states in which England, Wales, Scotland and Ireland are convulsed by civil war, by unwanted for many constitutional novelty, by very high rates of losses of people and resources in war, by the uncertainties created for many by religious and ecclesiastical change, and that as a result of all of those, Britain could be seen as a failed state. And this, of course, extends to the empire overseas, because I mean, Ireland is in some respects part of that empire, but more broadly overseas, because the civil wars affect the colonies in North America and the West Indies as well. Now, clearly, the situation is very different 100 years later. It isn't that there is an end to potential instability. Jacobitism, as we've already discussed, puts a question mark against the British state and the British Empire until the mid-18th century. In one of the more interesting anticipations of American independence, if we wish to use the term America in this context, might have occurred in 1745-46 if Charles Edward Stuart, Bonnie Prince Charlie, had taken over in London and the colonies on the other side of the Atlantic had declared clearly and firmly against that and had sought, rather on the manner of Brazil, for example, in the early 19th century, maybe with a member of the British royal family to aid the cause of separation, but maybe not, to take a different path. That is hypothesis, of course, and counterfactual. But what I am trying to suggest is that rather than assuming one necessary relationship between imperial strength and British developments, one could see this as part of a mutually complicated, interacting, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, reaction throughout this period, which becomes more, not less, intense in the 18th century as the volume of economic interaction increases, and as the possibility of profit or revenue, appropriation, sharing, taxation, whatever terms you wish to use, or opposition to taxation, becomes correspondingly more intense. And all of these can be seen as playing a significant role in helping to power the British Empire towards what in the end happens, which is a schism, permanent separation of Britain from, in many senses, most significant in population terms in any way, white settler population terms, white settler colonies outside the British Isles, and one in which by the end of the century, as a result of the success of the American War of Independence, the British Empire is less, whatever we mean by white, less Protestant, less of European descent, and less governed by through self-governing colonies than had been in the situation prior to 1775. And it might be that we should see those as the significant elements to consider. Anyway, I thought I'd just say that by way of starting us off.
Well, it's a tremendous platform on which to have a discussion, Professor Black. I mean, one of the difficulties is that whatever aspect one picks out, you can look somewhere else and find another reason for why that wouldn't be. The role of coal in creating the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Well, there's plenty of coal in China, but there was no Industrial Revolution there. You know, the role of colonies and building an empire, well, as you gave the example of Portugal in Brazil. So it's in finding kind of causes and effects that there's this great problem of, you know, whenever you find something that seems to have created a particular aspect which you can identify, there seems to be something else which contradicts it. I want to start by saying, you know, how much of this is conscious policy in Westminster? How relevant is that? I mean, obviously the role of colonies being created, and you can go back to the 17th century with the plantations and with Jamaica. But after that, really, is this just individual traders, people just wanting to set up a new life and a new business elsewhere? Where do you see the role of state as the agent which drives these often very different forces?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I think, first of all, one needs to bear in mind that there are differences between the what we might call the imperial presence in terms of the organization of empire. I mean, for example, in some areas, Hudson's Bay, for example, or India, the key bodies are commercial trading companies. In other areas, let's say Gibraltar, it's a royal garrison. So there's an enormous range of organization, of the understanding of the colony within, if you like to use the term, the British imperial mind. We can ask in a second what that mind constitutes of. And therefore, linked to this, the degree of attention paid can vary enormously. Now, if we turn to what we might regard as the British imperial mind, I think it's necessary to understand that government in the 18th century was very small scale. There's a story told in the papers of Sir Robert Murray Keith, who was British ambassador in Vienna from 1772 to 1792. He gets very cross with Francis Marquess of Carmarthen, later 5th Duke of Leeds, who's foreign secretary and doesn't answer over 40 of his dispatches. And he writes back a sort of relatively acerbic note of, is there anybody there character? And he gets told that he has to withdraw that dispatch. He refuses to do so. He gets recalled to London. He goes along to the Foreign Office and finds that there is literally nobody in the building. Now, this might surprise you, but if you think about it at this stage, the total staff of the Foreign Office, including the lady who was paid to keep it clean, was 12. That included the Foreign Secretary, a noted libertine, but also a member of the House of Lords. Mind you, the people they put in the House of Lords at the moment, I'm not sure there's any contradiction there. It includes the two undersecretaries, both of whom were members of the House of Commons, therefore had other responsibilities, etc., etc. So the fact that on a weekday afternoon you should find nobody in the Foreign Office is not necessarily to be all that surprising. Now, the Board of Trade by that period under Hawkesbury was a much more efficient and impressive organisation. But I think it's fair to say that you could look earlier in the 18th century and find periods when the Board of Trade had, shall we say, a varied commitment to all of Britain's overseas interests, let's just put it like that. And I think one can also draw attention, without necessarily agreeing with the phrase, that one can note that an earlier historian referred to salutary neglect as his idea of how British policy towards the New World colonies operated in the 1730s. I actually think he's wrong. For example, major problems with Maroons, escaped slaves in Jamaica in the 1730s led to the deployment of large numbers of troops there, British regulars. So I don't think I would agree. What I would say is this is a state whose attention was only so much, and therefore, and its resources were only so much of information, money, of attention, and therefore some issues attracted more concern than others. Allowing for that, The British state of the 18th century was a pretty effective state. I mean, I'm talking this afternoon, having read at lunchtime about yet another farcical failure of the British state over the high-speed train project, the HST2. And, you know, I can't help but being mindful that ideas of secular progressivism, that we are better than people in the past, are more and more laughable the more and more one has experience of the present. So I would argue that within the limits of what was possible, and one has to include the communications of that period, actually, they didn't manage too badly a bad job. They got it wrong, as we know, in terms of understanding sufficiently what was going on in some of the colonies in the New World in the 1770s. Big failure, no two ways about that. But on the whole, given the resources they had and given the degree of significance, and as I've already tried to argue, the actual domestic economy was more important. Britain's foreign policy focused principally on its relations with neighbouring European states. Given these points, you have to actually argue, why should you expect the British government to have devoted as much attention to empire as some people imagine that it did? And one can play that through into the 19th century. In the 19th century, some colonies attracted a lot of attention, but most did not.
Mm-hmm. Well, one area where government policy clearly is important is trade and commerce. Britain becomes, through a series of measures, a free trade supporting nation between the 1820s and 1840s. But throughout the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, the British government is committed, like all other major nations, to protectionism and various forms of mercantilism. How relevant, maybe relevant is the wrong word, what do you see as the effects and consequences of the economic policies of successive British governments in the 18th and pre-free trade period in terms of how that relates to the decision to go for colonies and markets which are in the colonies as distinct from just trading with whoever has products to sell?
Well, I've written a whole book on trade and foreign policy in the 18th century, so to try and summarise it in a few aphorisms is not something I'm terribly keen on. I would not put mercantilism as foremost in British foreign policy objectives. I would put security as foremost. And I would also argue that if you wish to think in profit-loss equations, actually a lot of empire was of dubious benefit from that point of view. But you correctly say that what we would call protectionism was the norm, that it starts to attenuate. William Pitt the Younger famously refers to the theories of Adam Smith when explaining in the House of Commons his support for the commercial treaty with France, the Eden Treaty, named after William Eden, First Lord Auckland, that he has supported the negotiation of. But I think it's fair to say that many people regarded this as fanciful. And Adam Smith, like many people, had more followers after he was dead than during his lifetime. What I would suggest to you is that British ministers were aware of the value of colonies, but actually a lot of their time when they're pursuing commercial negotiation, they are trying to improve negotiation commerce with other European powers. So you see, for example, the Anglo-Russian Trade Treaty of 1734, which is a very good book, old book by a chap called Redding, which is followed by relatively good commercial and political relations with Russia till the 1760s. Now, that's important to the government. And it tends to be, those kind of things tend to be ignored, or Peter Dixon's work on Anglo-Austrian commercial negotiations and hopes from the 1730s to the 1750s is also important. Or the successive attempts, which Richard Pears wrote about, and also Lodge, actually, these successive attempts to improve Anglo-Spanish commercial relations. So what I would argue is that we're overly keen to think that commerce was simply a matter of empire building, and that that was not the case in the 18th century. And it's another example of what troubles me greatly the more I read, you know, and I've been doing this job for now a long time, nearly a half century, in a sense, I've been doing advanced level history. And that is that so much of the work on it is facile. People have an idea, you know, empire equals X, or not quite the same thing, X equals empire, and they postulate a causal relationship. And it troubles me that they don't put enough weight on the complexities of analysis, the need to contextualize what people were doing, and the fact that often people in the past and the present are holding a number of, in some respects, contradictory ideas and policies in their mind at the same time. And I would see that as the situation if one is looking at Britain and empire in the 18th century. And I would also go one further point, and I would say this: different branches of history attract people of differing skills. And at the risk of being offensive, I don't mean to be offensive, this is a historiographical viewpoint, I think a lot of the subject of the British Empire is vitiated because the academics in question know little or nothing about other empires, both European empires, and even worse, they know little or nothing about non-European. I mean, many of the people that beat up on Britain as racist, you could argue, are showing a very curious idea of whatever they might mean by racial justice in their complete ignorance of non-European empires. And I would suggest that it tends to attract relatively low-grade historians. If I was looking for people on the 18th century of greater intellectual acuity, I think I would look for intellectual historians, historians of science, historians of religion. I would not be looking, on the whole, there are one or two honourable exceptions, but I would not be looking for historians of empire. And I think they get even worse when you get into the 19th and 20th centuries.
One of the consequences of certainly what's at the popular end of imperial scholarship is to create a broad perception that Britain became economically successful because of the Industrial Revolution, and the Industrial Revolution was made possible through the empire and particularly through slavery. Like all rather simplistic ideas, it's easy to attack, and you know, many of the resources in the 19th century for British for British industry were not coming from imperial possessions at all. But how advanced really is the research in pinpointing where the investments from the 18th century empire, where those investments went? Can we see where they went into industry? Can we see where they went into the London property market, or were, you know, spent on fripperies or a day at the races? How advanced is our scholarship in actually discerning where the money went?
Well, a lot of the money, first of all, the money went. It's an interesting question, because as you realise, what you're talking about in many senses is credit rather than liquidity, because liquidity, as I think I've mentioned, is under-realised in this period. There isn't the full use of paper instruments. Much of what you might call the money went to sustain the cost of the imperial, if you wish to use the term project. I regard that as a silly term, but that's the term that often people use. So, for example, the East India Company, as you may know, got regularly very cross, the shareholders at Leadenhall Street, about the cost of sustaining a military presence within India. And this becomes more, not less serious with time. It's a very big issue in the 1800s. It's one of the major criticisms made of Wellesley, Wellington's elder brother. And it underlines the difficulty of trying to work out what you mean by profit and loss. I mean, you could argue, if you wish to talk about profit, that the salaries of the army officers in India, and indeed the payments made to native soldiers in the military labour market, which is a very important labour market in India, were part of the profit of empire. It's part of where the money went. So you shouldn't assume that money necessarily comes to England. I think that's an important point. The same in North America. In actual fact, in a colony like Massachusetts, it's running a significant debt, so that far from money being remitted to London, it's the other way round, or goods are not being paid for, which is another way of looking at it. So I would argue that we need to have a conceptually and methodologically much more acute understanding of this issue, an understanding of empire as a shared project, if you wish to use that term. I would call it actually a shared mess, but there we go, because project suggests some directing organization, and there wasn't a directing organization. The interesting aspect, since you mentioned slavery, I think too much of the discussion, you know, slavery is horrible, there's no two ways about it, but too much of the discussion about empire is in terms simply of slavery. Of course, the shared interests there are as much held by the political and commercial networks within Africa that generated slaves, enslaved people, for the trade, as they are with whatever you might call the traders. And you could argue that this process should be more generally understood, that the British presence in India only worked as a result of a shared benefit system, including not only native allies, not only native soldiers who fought for the British, but also mercantile and financial interests that found it important and worthwhile to ally with them. So I'm not happy with what to my mind is a very, I'm not implying that you're being crude, I know you're just reflecting a sort of standard, rather ignorant trope that's out there, that in some way Britain is leeching off the rest of the world or the rest of empire. I think that's an enormous misunderstanding of how imperial systems worked in that period.
I mean, in its last decades, the East India Company was trading at a loss.
Oh, a lot of, a lot of these activities made a loss, and it could be fairly said that in many respects, if you think about many individual colonies, their value is problematic. Now, obviously, they can produce benefit for the servants of empire who are there, but in terms of their cost to the exchequer, It's often very poor. I've recently been doing some work on railway history, and I was very struck by reading accounts of discussion in the 1900s, 19-teens of building railways in West Africa, of the arguments that were being voiced by contemporaries, knowledgeable contemporaries, that this was absolutely ridiculous, that, you know, these things were going to cost a lot of money, they were never going to yield benefit, why on earth were we doing them? And I think one has to be aware that these issues are much more complex than they are often presented.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a strong point on which to end, as sadly we must. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.